Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, Brexit blues, as the Bank of England predicts the worst year for the economy since the recession. Project fear, or just project reality? Inflation down, interest rates going nowhere, but we do have some good news for savers. Also today, warnings about very costly 35-year mortgage small print, how to play and win the Air Miles credit card game, and we look at how to bag a holiday bargain. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
But first, we got the Bank of England quarterly inflation report this week, and it made, well, for pretty grim reading. The bank slashed its growth forecast to its lowest annual rate since the recession a decade ago. The B word is apparently wreaking havoc on the economy. Consumer confidence is down, businesses aren't spending, interest rates may not rise until next year. We also got the news that inflation dipped below its 2% target to a two-year low. But it's not all gloom and doom. More savings accounts than ever offer rates higher than inflation, and wages are up. So, Simon, pull all this together, would you? A warm welcome, by the way, and a warm welcome to you, Lee. But first, before you do that, the quarterly inflation report, what is it? What is the point?
The quarterly inflation report is where the Bank of England outlines what it thinks is going to happen to inflation. This is fundamental for what it thinks will happen to interest rates, because the primary function of monetary policy is to target inflation of 2% and then also to support the economy. And it also says what it thinks is going to happen to the economy. Now, last time the Bank of England updated us on this in November, it looked a bit more bullish that things were going okay, despite the concerns over Brexit and worries about global trade and Donald Trump arguing with China and all the other things that you might want to worry about, and indicated that, you know, it was going to stick with its path for interest rates and they might go up middle of this year, roughly, another time from the 0.75% that they're at. In the latest inflation report, they were a bit more downbeat.
Yeah.
Now, what
I've been away. So what happened when I've been away that we've gone from quite bullish to, let's say, pessimistic?
Well, the thing I would say is that you haven't been away since November.
That's true,
you
sadly.
You have been here for most
mentally.
Of that time, yes. And what the Bank of England said in November was that its forecasts for growth, expectations for interest rates and inflation were based on an orderly Brexit. Now, I'm not sure.
Because there was loads of indication at the time that that would happen,
I'm not sure what the Bank of England's exact definition of orderly is, but I suspect they might be looking at the meant to be leaving in 6 weeks, don't appear to have a plan thing, and think that it might fall outside the brackets of orderly, and is thus thinking that maybe it might rein things in a bit. Because what's going on, I think, is a lot of going around in circles. I was going to say nothing, but
I was going to say
it's not strictly true.
Yeah.
We appear to be having a series of votes that get us nowhere. There is this suggestion that there might just be some heel dragging going on to force through a deal at the last moment, that this could backfire, that we could end up leaving with no deal. I think the chances of no deal are now substantially higher than they were, even though Parliament keeps trying to seize control of Brexit and stop us leaving with no deal. And amid all of this mess, what is going on is, I think there's quite a lot of businesses going, we're leaving with no deal. And we're just going to be a little bit cautious over the next few months. We've got consumers being a little bit more cautious. We had some a pretty rough December, Christmas time for retailers and things like that. Inflation has come down to 1.8%. That's good news because it's now below target. It's become below target sooner than thought. But we've gone from worrying about inflation being too high to, oh no, inflation's a bit low now, as in the great soap opera of inflation. So it's all pointing to a little bit of a slowdown going on, which means interest rates probably not going to go up as soon. And Bank of England going, yeah, we think growth might be a little bit lower. Things are being knocked off the edges. Not super low. It's not predicting recession or anything like that, but it's just saying a bit lower. Now, the irony is here that actually, away from all of this, people are getting pay rises. Real pay rises.
Yeah, so
a real pay rise is one where your pay goes up by more than inflation. Inflation's at 1.8%, and real pay, if wage increases maintain the path that they're on at the moment, real pay will be up about 1.4%. So that's good news. And
well, it is good news.
Puts a bit more money in their pocket.
Absolutely. And we talk about this erosion of cash as a result of inflation. But Lee, if the inflation number is coming down and we're going to be talking about savings accounts, more of them out there beating inflation and wages going up, is it just in relation to this figure going down, or are the other fundamentals, which mean people are actually getting paid more, that savings accounts are actually offering better rates? Or is it just in relation to this figure coming down?
There's a lot of mixed messages, isn't there? There's a bit of, we're not sure what's kind of going on at the moment, but a lot of that is down to the fact that we're not really too sure what's going to be happening in the short term in terms of Brexit. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are 6 weeks away now, and we still don't really quite know what's going to happen.
6 weeks.
There's been all sorts of rumours this week about extending Article 50, where Theresa May keeps on saying that actually, you know, we're still on track. But you think, but we don't really still kind of know what's going on. It's a tough one, but inflation, is 1.8% now. It's gone down for the fact of cheaper gas, electricity and petrol. We've seen petrol prices come down quite a bit in the last couple of months, and that's been largely to play here. What happens in the short term is really quite difficult. For the first time, I feel like it's really hard to know what's going to happen in the short term. We always talk about the long term on this show and what might happen over the course of the year, but now we are these weeks away.
How on earth do we know what's going to happen
exactly.
After 6 weeks?
Yeah, we just don't.
Which makes it really difficult. And the British Chamber of Commerce, Simon, came out and said that this is really difficult for businesses to know what on earth to do at the moment. I mean, it's sort of stating the bleeding obvious, I think. You didn't need the British Chamber of Commerce to say that businesses are going, we've got 6 weeks and we don't know what we're doing after that.
Yes, and I think that we've made a fundamental error in the Brexit negotiations.
Oh, right.
In that a long time ago, we should have made it abundantly clear to the EU that we were willing to leave with no deal, but then done some ostentatious planning for leaving with no deal to make it look like we really were prepared to leave with no deal and we really were prepared for it. What we did was we said no deal's better than a bad deal, and then didn't do any obvious planning for it. And then all of a sudden went into a little bit of a panic in about mid-December, early December time, by which point, obviously, it was far too late to do any of the planning, even if it was just planning for show. The EU doesn't really believe that we're going to leave with no deal because they think that it's going to be chaos because we haven't planned for anything and we can't even organise our railways. There's lots of things we can't organise in this country. So why we would think that we could add an extra level of complexity onto that, they think, well, they're not going to be able to do that. So because we didn't do any sort of ostentatious, hey, yeah, we're fine with no deal kind of stuff, they don't believe we'll leave with no deal.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're in this kind of position where we don't have the negotiating power that we would do of threatening to leave with no deal because they think that we're too scared to do it. And also businesses aren't convinced that we could leave with no deal because they haven't seen anybody doing any planning for it. So they're really worried that actually 6 weeks to go, we don't seem to have a plan. Now, obviously, you can't turn back time. You can't jump back in the DeLorean and start doing some, you know, ostentatious planning on the M20 for all those roadblocks and things like that. So what do we do?
So
the government's saying, yeah, we're writing to businesses. We've been meeting with businesses. We've been doing this. I think businesses, to be perfectly honest, you know, the BCC, it feels compelled to put out this warning. I think on an individual level, from the business people I've been speaking to, they're just saying, no, look, we're just planning for this now. We're just basically making it a priority that we're planning for this, expecting some disruption. And if we don't get disruption, we'll be fine. I mean, the great irony is there's now a public groundswell of opinion for no deal,
yeah.
You know, because people are so fed up with the EU. They're just like, you know what? Yeah, let's just leave. Stuff them. I mean, that is cutting off your nose to spite your face in a way, but it shows the complete breakdown on both sides. And I talked about this as if this was the UK's fault, but it's not. It's equally the EU's fault. And you can guarantee that if, you know, businesses in the UK are complaining about this, businesses in Germany are complaining about this as well. They are not happy on the continent about what's going on either.
Of course, I don't want to get too bogged down in what's going to happen, Lee, in the next sort of 6 weeks. I do agree with Simon, though. I think the no deal has become almost the default, that if you wanted Brexit, it's the only Brexit. But, you know, let's not go there.
No, I think there's lots of people who didn't want Brexit, who were the swing voters, who could have gone either way. They were like, well, do you know what? Actually, I'm not going to vote for it, but I can kind of see the merits. Loads of those people are now like, we should just stick two fingers up to the
relief. But if that's why a lot of people wanted to vote in the first place, well, isn't this proving exactly that, one, our elites in this country aren't listening, and certainly EU elites aren't listening and aren't willing to negotiate. So, of course, people, if they were thinking originally, let's just stuff them, and now thinking even more, let's just give them the two fingers.
And I think that this feeds back to...
I'm not saying
the,
anyone
the,
in this room thinks
yeah,
that,
but,
I'm
but,
just
but
saying.
Rather than turning it into a Brexit rant, this steers back to the thing that I was saying, is that I think the businesses are just going, do you know what, actually, sod the politicians, we're going to sort this thing out ourselves and just prepare for it. And if we end up with a plan, great. If we don't end up with a plan, at least we've done what we need to. But they are very, very disappointed in the government, the opposition, the EU, and all of the people involved in officialdom who have turned this whole thing into a massive mess.
But isn't that what great businesses do? Look, they prepare for the unexpected, whatever that may be. I mean, Brexit is obviously the big issue at the moment, but to be a good business, Lee, you know, you've got to prepare for these, any eventuality.
It's very true, and actually Simon is completely correct. You think about any big business that's based in Britain or in Europe, you know, this has now been going on since 2016, the possibility they would have sat down and looked at all of the scenarios that could have come into play. I'm sure that no deal Brexit would have been one of the you know, scenarios that were in play. That's now looking, you know, quite likely to happen. The thing is, for small businesses and for other bigger businesses, is that they can't really judge what the British public are going to do, you know, just after if we left, crashed out with no deal, whether people start panicking and, you know, hoarding money and not doing the usual spending patterns that we would see, and whether people will just start cutting back, they panic and worry over job cuts and job losses. You know, how will global businesses perceive Britain? Will they start looking to move, you know, more headquarters out of Britain and into EU countries? And is that going to have a knock-on effect onto jobs and et cetera, et cetera? There's a lot of aftermath that it's very hard to predict on what would happen in the wake of a no deal Brexit. But there's definitely one thing that's certain. There's a lot of people, you know, talking about this groundswell and people sticking two fingers up at Europe and going, trouble is, we're sticking up two fingers and realizing how difficult it is to unmarry yourself from the EU. And I think actually there's a lot of citizens of other EU countries that might not believe in the EU project and perhaps want to see their country leave the EU, but seeing how difficult it is to get yourself out of the EU, that might even be giving stronger precedence to those kind of people that are going, this is, how is it so difficult to unmarry yourself from the EU?
We haven't even started.
We haven't even started
the unmarrying process. But this is just
Georgie,
the agreeing of how we're going to leave.
Georgie, as a journalist, you know, I love leaving things to the last minute, and you know, you've got a deadline. So I've got a deadline for 2 years' time. So what I'll do is I'll probably do it the night before.
That's what
I was like at university. Yeah. That's what I'm like in my work career. So perhaps, you know, we'll just do it nearer the time. We've got 6 weeks. That's ages.
Absolutely. In terms of my holiday planning and stuff, 6 weeks.
6 weeks. That's ages. I can get loads of things done by then.
Exactly. Exactly. We will be talking about savings accounts in a sec, but I do want to bring it closer to home. One thing we haven't mentioned is, you know, we're talking about the aftermath of Brexit. Well, what about what's been going on and the sentiment beforehand? One big issue is the housing market, Simon. We're seeing price rises are slowing across the UK. London and the South East continue to be hit hard. The average cost of a home in the capital fell for the sixth consecutive month. Is this all about the Brexit effect?
Some of it is about the Brexit effect. Some of it is about houses being too expensive. And London, you can trace this back to pre-Brexit vote and to the point where people were queuing round the block to go view flats, and they were having open mornings with these queues, and then they were asking for sealed bids, and there was above asking price offers, and everything just got a little bit too out of control. And that was just a very peaky kind of scenario, and what usually happens after something like that is you get something of a downturn, and we're seeing that downturn now. Compounding that, you've got Brexit. There's more foreign buyers in London, you know, not super rich foreign buyers. I'm talking more like people from, you know, people who are Italian or French or Spanish and working here. There's the buy-to-let squeeze that's hitting people. Extra tax, extra stamp duty on buying properties, 3% surcharge. Obviously, that's considerably more expensive if you're buying a more expensive property. Rental yields on properties were lower in London. People were willing to accept them because they thought house prices would keep rising. There's a crackdown on rental income tax for landlords as well, so that squeezes them, so therefore they're less likely to accept these lower yields. And then there's the whole, well, maybe we'll just sit on our hands and see what happens. The London market turned from being slower to less people making offers, to less people viewing, to less people putting stuff on the market, and just ended up in a kind of gridlock. Now, interestingly, a few estate agents I've been talking to are telling me that they've been pretty busy since New Year, and that actually they've been surprisingly busy, that they went into January having had an absolutely dead period pretty much from end of October through to obviously December, expecting the new year to be really, really quiet, and all of a sudden people wanted to look at properties, and people didn't just want to look at properties, they were actually making offers on properties. Now, the problem is there's a shortage of properties for sale in this market that's been a bit slow in London, the commuter belt, the southeast and stuff. But that's now encouraging people to put a few more properties on the market. And they're suggesting that actually they reckon the traditional spring home buying season might be quite busy, and that now might be a good time if you're thinking of wanting to try buy somewhere at a slightly lower price. It's a buyer's market.
Yeah, if you need a house,
that it's
as
not
well,
a bad time
a
to buy. And so, yeah, that it's tempting a few people who don't have to sell, the kind of death and divorce and debt kind of brigade. It's tempting a few more people who are just thinking, oh, I'd quite like to move home out there. Now, obviously, look outside of London and the commuter belt, and it's a different story. So the major regional cities have been doing okay. They've been doing quite well. Things have looked much better in the Midlands, has been the UK's biggest property hotspot. Things apparently have slowed a little bit there. They're not going quite as gung-ho as they were. But the difference there is, of course, that properties aren't as expensive. So they are still expensive compared to wages historically, but the gap is narrower than it is in London and the South East. And the cost of moving up the ladder, you know, to a place with an extra bedroom is maybe £30,000 or £50,000 rather than £100,000 or £200,000. And, you know, even though wages are lower there, it's easier to jump that gap than it is for someone in London and the South East. But word on the street is things are looking a little bit more active than estate agents were expecting.
We shall see. Who knows what's going to happen in the next 6 weeks, 6 months, whatever. Well, that's house price inflation. Lee, inflation generally, which we spoke about, means that there are so many more savings accounts that beat inflation. Good news, but there's a but in there.
Yes, there's actually a couple of buts in there, Georgie. So there's now around about 250 savings accounts that beat inflation, which is great. Last month, there was 100 or so. And last year, there was hardly any at any point that beat inflation. So it's a little chink of light for savers. And actually, I know we've spoken about this on the podcast not that long ago, but actually savings rates are kind of nudging a little bit higher. I'm not saying they're going up, you know, really quickly, but there's been some enhanced competition. It's starting to drive up rates just very gradually. We're just seeing as the years go past, just a little 0.1% here, 0.2% here of rises. So it's good news for savers. What I would say is it's better news for those who have lump sums who can fix and put money away. So the top 1 year fix is 2.1%. Which, you know, is inflation beating by some margin now. And then the top 2 year rate is 2.35%. And then if you lock your cash away for 5 years, it's 2.68%. Now, what I would say about that is, of course, inflation measure will change in that period. So it's not guaranteed that you're going to constantly be beating inflation over that time. But it's still a sign of better times for savers. The other thing to say is on our ISAs, so we've got ISA season, as we used to call it, coming up from March to May, with your new allowance coming in April. You have to fix for 2 years of an ISA if you want to beat inflation. So the rates aren't as good. On offer are not as good. We've spoken about this before, about it's mainly because competitors don't want the red tape of having to deal with the tax man and having to, you know, it's more complicated to open ISAs, basically. So you can fix 2 years, get 1.91%. You can't still get an easy access rate that beats inflation. Top rates are 1.5%. So we're not quite at that level yet where easy access is just, you know, really sort of easy products in which you put money in and you can dip in and out when you want. Even though we had Marcus launched last year, nothing's really kind of happened since then. There's been a couple of rates here and there that have nudged past. So it's better news for savers. There might still be better options out there for people, such as stocks and shares, ISA, if you're looking to invest in the long term. But that we are seeing a bit of light for savers. And what I think the next step would be is to see one or two big banks or building societies start to offer, even if they were semi-competitive rates. And actually, there's a lot of people out there that have money in, you know, accounts that 0.1%, 0.2%, 0.3% that have just been left stale somewhere and just thinking, well, is it worth my time to move this money to 1.5% or 2%? And as we keep saying, if you are one of those people, move your money. Until you move your money out of these big banks, it's just going to continue in that vein.
Well, if you want more information about savings, do listen back to our special savings podcast, which we recorded, I believe, about 3 weeks ago.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Now, Lee, your nose for a story never stops sniffing, does it? Even when you popped into your local bank to pay in a cheque, remember those? But that is not the story, the return of cheques. No, what you spotted is an advert above the paying-in machines related to your favourite Swedish flat pack home furnishing company. Well, it's not really about that at all, actually. It's about 35-year mortgages. But I will let you take up the story. What did you notice, Lee?
Well, look, there's no problem with this, but what it was, I went into HSBC and they were everywhere bombarded with these ads about 35-year, our extended 35-year rate mortgage, right? Which, it's fine. It's just
What's an average?
So traditionally, it used to be 25 years.
Right.
So this is an extra 10 years now. It's more like 30 years for people, but now we're starting to talk about 35 years like it's the norm. And I've even heard of 40 years. Oof. I mean, that's a long old time to be having a mortgage. So what happened was, is a bit of a couple of parts of this story. I was speaking to some friends over the weekend who have an offer pending and they've got a mortgage approved where they're buying. And my friend said to me that my lender has recommended a 40-year term, which I thought, blimey, they're not for 40 years. I didn't actually realise. I didn't actually know that there was terms that are that long. I thought 35 years was sort of the max. And I thought, well, okay. I didn't really want to get too involved because sometimes you don't want to start going, well, actually, have you crunched the figures? But it kind of got my brain whirling. And then when I went into the HSBC and they had this glossy advert about, you know, more time to build your flat pack furniture, you know, just a really weird link anyway. It's not going to take you, well, it could take you 35 years.
Yeah.
I've built some of that stuff from IKEA and it's not easy. But it was just the way that it kind of made it the norm. So I felt like it was almost like trying to get into your psyche if you're a first time buyer to go, well, yeah, 35 years, you know, I'm going to have lower monthly payments. So that's what happens, right? The longer the term, the lower the monthly payments.
But the more the bank gets.
But the more the bank gets because of the interest. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that you're going to have that mortgage for 35 years because you might go to remortgage and you can bring the term down. And it might work for you short term to get that step onto the property ladder. But in the case of my friend, they didn't understand what a mortgage term meant. They don't really kind of get it. And actually, there's quite a lot of people that find mortgages quite difficult to get their head around, which is quite a worrying thing if it's going to be your biggest financial commitment and probably the biggest outlay of your life. People get kind of blindsided with got to get on the property ladder any means necessary. And it's whether people are doing their homework and having a look to see what fits them best. And they started talking about they can overpay the mortgage by 10% a year, which is great. And I, you know, actively encourage if you can do it and you can overpay your mortgage a little bit. But it started to get me thinking, well, if you were going to do that, if you were going to start overpaying on your mortgage, surely you would, with the idea of chipping away at your mortgage term, why wouldn't you just go for a slightly shorter mortgage term?
Flexibility, freedom, just in case.
But it adds tens of thousands of pounds.
Oh, tell us some of the figures. What are you talking?
Cost. So if you were going to take out a mortgage on it on one of the HSBC products I spotted, which was a two-year fix for those who have a 10% deposit, which would be a kind of typical first-time buyer, over 30 years, borrowing £400,000, because I was in Kensington, I thought I'd go a little bit higher than the national average. You'd pay back £564,000 cards once interest and fees and charges and all that are added on. Now, if you added that onto 35 years, it would be £595,000. I mean, that's basically a typical annual salary of someone difference. That's a lot of money. What I tried to say in this column was that there's nothing wrong with taking out a longer term mortgage, especially if you are younger and you know, you may be in your early 20s or mid 20s or late 20s. But when you start getting a little bit older than that, I would start thinking about what you can afford and actually just doing some simple calculations and crunching the numbers to see what kind of interest you're talking about and whether it stacks up to be overpaying a mortgage, whether it stacks up to have a shorter mortgage term. And basically just do your homework and try and get you, it's almost like get your head around what a mortgage is and how it works, because it's such a big deal.
Simon?
Lee's right in that he used this high figure because it's an advert in the Kensington branch. Mm-hmm. There's probably loads of people in Kensington borrowing bigger mortgages than that. But then also, if you borrow a more normal £150,000, the cost of having a 35-year mortgage rather than a 30 or a 25 one is significantly higher. So 35 years on £150,000, if you in the unlikely event that you had a steady mortgage rate of 2.44% over the lifetime, would cost you £216,000 to pay back, whereas over 25 years it will cost you £196,000. So that's a difference of £20,500. Yeah. That's a lot. That's a significant amount when you compare it to what you're actually paying back.
That's a huge
amount. The way that this works is that twofold. One, banks are encouraging people to take longer term mortgages because houses are expensive and they need to try and to find ways for people to be able to afford to keep paying those high prices. One way of doing that is cutting the monthly payments. And the other thing it helps people do is meet mortgage affordability tests. So under the mortgage rules, you have to do it on affordability, monthly payments, people's incomings and outgoings. The great irony is that by applying those and getting people to pass the affordability tests, you're actually costing them tens of thousands of pounds more over the life of the mortgage. Even in instances where people don't need to do it to pass the affordability test, they're choosing it because they're like, oh yeah, well, save us £150 a month. I could do that extra £150 a month. I will give you an example of this. My brother asked me this question a couple of years back when him and his girlfriend were buying a house. He said, yeah, we were going to do a 25-year term mortgage, but then the mortgage broker mentioned this, you know, I think it was 35 years or something. And we said, well, maybe we could save £150 a month. That'd be quite good. And I said to him, well, look, could you afford to pay the extra £150 a month? And he's like, yeah, we could do. It's like, I said, do you need that £150 a month? He's like, no, we'd be all right. I was like, well, take the shorter term mortgage because it's going to cost you loads more over the years. It feels cheaper, but it's not cheaper. It's much more expensive. And they did take the shorter term.
Did he listen to Brother Simon?
Yeah, he did. He took the shorter term mortgage. But the temptation is obvious, isn't it? But it will cost you more in the long run. The other mistake that people make is when they move up the property ladder is redoing the mortgage term. So they're effectively extending it. So you move into your first property, you live there for 5 years, you get a 30-year mortgage because that's quite most commonplace amongst first-time buyers now. You then move to your next place and instead you take out a new mortgage to buy the next place. But instead of going on the 25 years that you're now on, you go back up to 30 because it makes it that bit more affordable. Now, the problem is, of course, if you keep doing that, then you never end up paying off the mortgage, or your mortgage that started off as a 30-year mortgage ends up as a 40-year mortgage. I mean, there have previously been limits on this because lenders need you to pay it off by retirement. But the problem is the retirement date is going further into the future as well. And now they're being a lot more lax about whether people can go into retirement with it. So people need to be careful, otherwise they'll just end up with a never-ending mortgage. And the only person who benefits from a never-ending mortgage is the bank or the building
and
society.
And we don't want them to benefit, do we? All right, well, this is the time. It's about the time, isn't it, when we're fed up of the cold weather. Being broke after January, our minds are somewhat distracted by thoughts of jetting off to sunnier climes, or in my case... Yeah, no, that's still the case with me. I've just got back. I'm still thinking about sunnier climes. What better way to save, though, than using air miles for the airfare? Loads of credit cards out there you can use to rack up your miles, but are they worth it? Because earlier this month, This Is Money reported on how Virgin Atlantic Reward Plus credit card holders had ended up accruing £1,500 in interest charges due to the card defaulting to minimum payments. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, the actual card itself comes with an annual fee of £160 and a hefty 63.9% APR. But that is not even the highest, Lee. So look, what are these cards that offer these air miles, and are they worth it? Because 63.9% and £160.
Well, Georgie, they can be worth it. They're not as worthwhile as they once were. The points aren't as generous as they once were, and the rewards on offer aren't as generous as they once were. But there is a whole army of Britons out there that love to collect air miles and love to do their everyday spending on credit cards, play the rules of the game, and end up getting, you know, some reduced flights around the world. It can be done. You can play the game to your advantage. But, of course, as with any game, there's lots of penalties to watch out for and hurdles to jump and things that can have a sting in the tail. So you have to be very careful. So the first bit of advice I would always say with these kind of credit cards is don't ever use it as a normal credit card per se. You have to use it, spend on it and pay it off straight away. Otherwise, right, you do get stung with some of these absolutely astronomical charges. So we had a look at what some of these reward cards and the steepest APRs. So there's a British Airways Amex Premium Plus, that's 76% APR. The Virgin Atlantic Reward Plus, 63.9% as you say. And Amex Preferred Rewards Gold, 57.6% APR. So, you know, high costs of getting into debt and not doing what you're meant to do with it. That Virgin Atlantic card, actually, we'd written a story on that, because what happened was there was a big wave of customers that had an MBNA incarnation of that card. It got closed down. They got encouraged to open up, you know, basically very similar terms with this new credit card. And actually, when they went through, they didn't realise that it wasn't set to, you know, paying off the full balance. So it was only paying off the minimum balance. Right. And some people got absolutely stung on it. Virgin were pretty, like, well, it was in the terms and conditions. It was kind of your fault type thing.
Tricky so statement as well.
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit, you know, and actually some of the people who got in touch with us were ex-Virgin Money employees who said, you know, this is not what the ethos of the bank was. So anyway, that's Virgin Money's prerogative. I understand it as the terms and conditions, but I can see how people fell for it. Anyway, that aside, you can play the game. So what you have to do is you've got to factor in all of the annual fees. So most of them come with an annual fee, but not all of them. A lot of them come up with sign-up bonuses. So you might get an X amount of points for X amount of spend within 3 months. Rule number one, as I said earlier, is you have to make sure that you're paying it off on a monthly basis, because we spoke to an expert, Rob Burgess, who heads up Head for Points, a website that's, you know, massively popular. And what he tells us is, people that don't pay off that balance, as soon as you don't pay off and you get any kind of interest, you're going to just eat into any potential reward, and it just makes it completely not worth it. But interestingly, I thought that the interest would be the main way that banks sort of trip people up with these cards. And that's, you know, I think that's a pretty fair assumption, isn't it? You look at the APR.
Yeah.
But actually, the way I thought was really interesting that these cards make more money is the people that book the flights to it and, you know, play the game, get the air miles, take the card with them on their trip, because it's kind of been done via the card and they like to do their everyday spending with it, but then they spend it overseas and they come with crazy fees to spend overseas on. What part of that will be is a lot of people that use these cards for business, for example. So there'll be a lot of business people that have the card set up through their work, so it doesn't really matter to them too much. So they put all of this spending through, this discretionary spending through, and it kind of tots up, and then you can get some.
But
nice
if that's
flights.
Not you.
But if it's not you, that is the main way that these cards make their money. And in a roundabout way, you end up paying for someone else's trip, really, if you do this type of thing. And also, the other thing that kind of people forget about these air miles, and it's always worth bearing in mind, is that it can be good, but you're going to have to still pay taxes on these flights. So if you're doing long haul, taxes can be, you know, a couple hundred quid onto the cost of the flight. And sometimes it's hard to get peak flights and all that sort of thing. So you have to watch out for all those kind of traps. It can be a bit of a minefield.
Sounds like a palaver.
It is well worth having a read on some of these specialist websites. We've had a couple of stories in the past about, you know, how to maximise your points. So it's worth digging them out, having a look if you're tempted to get involved. But please do not take one of these out as a regular credit card. You have to have the money to pay it off at the end of the day every month. Otherwise, you are going to find yourself in a debt hole.
Some lovely tips there. Thank you very much, Lee. Well, another way to save on the price of holiday, particularly with the Brexit impact on the pound, is perhaps to go all-inclusive. More of us are thinking of going all in this summer, apparently, with the price dropping by over a third from a year ago. That's according to Travel Supermarket. Now, Simon, you've compiled a list of the top 10 most affordable all-inclusive family holiday destinations of 2019. But first, I have to admit, I'm not a big fan of all-inclusive. I did book when I went to Tenerife last summer for half of my holiday to be spent in a hotel of somebody that I knew, and it turned out to be all-inclusive. And anybody drinking green muck from, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, singing Agadoo with chips all over the place, literally, it was my idea of hell, and I lasted a day. And then I checked myself out again, trekked across the country that I've never been to, back to the original hotel in the north, which was lovely, by the way. Anybody else a fan here? Am I doing a disservice to all-inclusive?
I'm not a fan of the all-inclusive method of travel, as evidenced by the fact that I have only done it once in my life. I
can
definitely
off,
see the attraction. No, I thought it was awesome, but okay. I'm going to make a point that I was 18 years old.
Okay.
And when you're 18 years old, I went to the Caribbean with my family, and we originally stayed somewhere else, and then it basically turned out that the beach there wasn't really a beach. It was a concrete platform and stuff, and we decided to move, and we went to Club Antigua, it was called. And it's got, you know, lots of swimming pools, and you can get free food and free drink all day long. So as an 18-year-old, free beer on tap that you can help yourself to and as many burgers as you can eat is awesome, because when you're 18, you can drink as much of that free beer on tap and eat as many of those burgers as you like, and it's not going to affect you. And you're not so worried about the quality of said beer, said burger, or the food. As a 40-year-old now, I'd probably be going there and going, that is a crap burger.
Yeah.
I don't want to eat another burger, and that beer is rubbish. You know, paying, and then you pay for the other drinks, don't you? But so I've never been back, but I have heard from people who've been to much nicer all-inclusives that do good food, good drink, etc., that it's great, it's very relaxing. But I'm very much I don't really do package holidays either.
No.
I do book my own flights, book my own car hire, book my own place to stay. Now, what's interesting is apparently that all-inclusive is the most popular single form of package holiday. And it used to be half-board was very popular.
Yeah,
I have done half-board recently.
Is it
when I went snowboarding to Austria the other weekend, a lot of the hotels there tend to be half-board, and they do really nice food in the evening. So that's worth
half
it. But my memory of these kind of half-board or inclusive kind of things is of getting not very good dinners. I mean, I remember one year
buffet.
We got a really cheap package holiday snowboard trip to this. I think we paid like 280 quid or something for the week. Flights, transfers, hotel, half-board. I think we ate in the hotel about twice in the week. The food was so lousy. But if you go for the more expensive stuff, then it's pretty good.
Family?
I have only been on one all-inclusive in my life as well, and actually I'm a bit of a holiday snob. And what happens is I tend to go away and take on too much. I always feel like there's a bit of a pressure to sort of take, do you know what I mean? You go somewhere and you want to see this site and you want to go here and there because you might not ever go back to that place. And
never
then,
plan,
and then it,
ever.
I
go like the day before I'm meant to be there.
No,
that's
so I can't travel like that. It's just, that's
I booked
just
my
much.
Trip to the Galapagos. I went to the Galapagos recently, by the way. I booked it on the Tuesday, got confirmation on the Friday, got final confirmation 3 hours before I was due to leave
that,
for the airport.
That stresses
on Monday.
Me out. But that stresses
so within
me
less
out,
than
Georgie.
A week, I was off.
But what I'm trying to say is we did this all-inclusive one year, a couple of years ago, because we both, my partner and I, felt a bit burnt out. And we said, we always go on holiday and we end up needing another holiday when we come back on the holiday, because we go somewhere, like we go to Sardinia, for example. And then instead of just staying in one place in Sardinia, we drive around the whole circumference of the island to make sure we're not missing out on something. So we went to Fuerteventura, which is on the list, actually.
It is.
We went in December. The weather was pretty good. Now, the reason we picked it, I must admit, I'm quite lucky that my partner used to work in the hotel industry, so she kind of knows what's good and what to look out for and whatnot. We were there for a week. She picked it. This is going to sound so snobbish, but I don't really care. She picked it because
it
was popular with German holidaymakers rather than English holidaymakers. So you kind of feel a little bit like more like you're on holiday instead of just sitting around a pool with English people, if you know what I mean.
You feel like you're on holiday in Germany.
You're like, yeah, exactly. It's like we're on holiday in Germany, but with the weather.
Obviously, I'm wondering if it's because Germans are more discerning. And that's why it's just like, no, you just don't want to hang around with Brits.
But and the other, yeah, I don't know. I hate going away and like having small talk with people around the pool. It's like my idea of a nightmare. I don't want to talk about what I do at home. That's the whole reason why I'm on holiday. holiday. I don't want to talk about my life. I just want to clock off and not think about it. And if people are German, I don't need to speak to them. They don't want to know. So it's great. Also, it had a classic buffet. The food was good, but it had three restaurants. You had a voucher for each one to use when you wanted over the week. And one was like a steak restaurant. Another one was like a fish restaurant. And it was actually really good. The food was really good. The alcohol was made it even better. Mm. And we just went there, flop and fly. It was lovely. Loved it. It was good.
So it can be good.
It can be.
Don't worry now, we've just said that, because you've compiled your list. And on there was Fuerteventura, but also Spain makes the top 5 out of 10.
Yeah, it's value for money, isn't it? Your Costas, your Costa Bravas, your Costa Doradas, your Costa Blancas, your Costa whatnot.
Whatever.
your Costa Holidays is lower.
You know, they're always going to be popular with Brits. You know, short hop on the flight, isn't it, to get there.
So you're not going to those.
In at number two, though, is Agadir, Morocco, not to be mistaken with Agadoo, Georgie.
Sunny Beach, Turkey, Corfu, Crete, they're all on the list. They offer good value for money for people that are looking to do all-inclusive. I think people do get nervous because of what the food might be like. And as you say, I don't particularly like going on holiday and not walking out of the hotel at night and going and trying to restaurants
part.
And stuff. But there is sometimes something to be said for just going somewhere and completely clocking off, books around the pool, not having to think about where you're eating for dinner, looking at a million and one TripAdvisor reviews as to whether the restaurant nearby is any good, has it got an English menu, and blah, 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 blah. You know, it's just, I found it just really relaxing. I found it a really easy way to clock off. I read about 5 books and it was great. But I would say if you're going to do it, and you're going to do it for the first time, there are a number of things you have to watch out for. And one of the big ones is the small print and what's included. Because sometimes, you know, for the classic one is not premium spirits, for example. So if you know, you're going to be drinking some sort of strange vodka that's been made out of a vat somewhere. I'm not too keen on that sort of stuff. So you want to make sure what you're getting included. I think that restaurant tip's important, because you don't really want to be eating in a buffet restaurant every single night and lunch and breakfast, same place all the time.
Yeah.
It's good if it has separate, you know, more like a special restaurant somewhere on the site, so you can kind of dress up and, you know, eat a better meal, hopefully. And it actually always pays to look at what day of the week you're flying. You get that classic Friday, Saturday churn of people coming in, and, you know, because they don't want to book off time of holiday. You go sort of Wednesday to Wednesday, for example, you might be able to save quite a bit of cash doing that. You want to make sure that it's hassle protected. Especially, I think there's a bit of holiday booking anxiety at the moment because of Brexit. I think people are a bit worried that, is the insurance going to cover them? So just make sure you do your homework before you go. Just don't get too bogged down in reading 1,001 TripAdvisor reviews and then antagonising over the one negative review, which I do.
I just cut out the real top ones and the real bottom ones and kind of read the sort of middling ones. I just think...
The middle flab.
Yeah, the top ones are probably written by staff. The bottom ones, well, you're probably really annoyed. So someone in the middle. Simon, to wrap this all up and to come back to where we started, should we be thinking about going on holiday? Who knows what's going to happen in 6 weeks?
I tell you what, if you want a cheap holiday, then maybe you should. Holiday industry has been absolutely hammered the first few months of this year and the end of last year. Again, word on the street, nobody's been booking holidays. There is the Brexit concern. So obviously the problem is Brexit happens just before the school holidays at Easter. So flights that by now you would have normally expected to have gone up in price by a lot haven't. Holidays aren't being booked. That means there's some really good deals to be had. People have been told there won't be chaos. We have been told that flights will be taken off as expected, that there is an agreement, even if we have no deal, for flights to be fine. I think people don't necessarily believe it. We've all suffered trying to get from Dover to Calais, Calais to Dover, or seen what happens when the air traffic controllers in France go on strike and manage to trash flights to everywhere in the world because of the knock-on effect of airport carnage. So I think people are holding off. Apparently there's more people booking staycations, so they're booking to stay in this country. So if you're a contrarian and you're willing to gamble and put up with a little bit of discomfort if things do go awry, then cheap holidays all the way.
Crack on. Our readers
don't appear completely convinced by some of these destinations, though.
No.
And there's a lot of grumbles in the comments about them all being 3 stars. They want 4 stars or better.
We have discerning readers, of course.
Exactly.
And listeners as well. Well, thank you very much for you tuning us out today with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any questions, comments, recommendations for 4-star places to go, Simon?
You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can email us, editor@thisismoney.co.uk, if you've got a problem that you would like us to solve. Perhaps your three-star hotel just wasn't up to scratch. Or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you can see the archive of all of our podcasts published, and you can read the stories, and you can argue about whether it's better to take a package holiday, to book it yourself, to go for 4 stars, 5 stars, or just not worry about the stars and find a nice little Airbnb to book in the comments.
Excellent. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? Helps people find us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.